So, I asked you last week to go ahead and read the rest of the handout that I gave you. Were there any objections or anything you'd like to discuss on that? We'll go ahead and go through it. I just wanted to address anything if there was anything to talk about. All right. So maybe there will be before the end of the evening, or before the end of the class time. Yes, the session. Thank you. All right. So last week we also talked about, we finished up talking about how long the cycle for the period of the judges was. Ended up being at most around 317 years, and then that would cover Judges chapter 3 to Judges chapter 16. That starts off with the Mesopotamian oppression and Othniel delivering them, and ending with Samson. And we're going to talk more into detail about that and the order of things that took place during that period later. But first we're going to start, we started talking about the events that Judges 17 through 21 cover. And I mentioned that it was my opinion that Judges 17 through 21 was written by a different author than the first part of Judges. And there's some, again, internal evidence. I think at the end of Judges 18, it talks about a captivity, that this particular thing happened until the captivity. And so I'm leaning towards that being the Assyrian captivity. But earlier on in Judges, it talks about something that hasn't happened yet. And that was about certain things that just hadn't happened at that point. And so it seemed like that first half, half, 1 through 16, was written earlier than the captivity. And so these two stories, 17 through 21, 17 and 18, the migration of Dan, 19 through 21, the war with Benjamin, did not happen after Samson. It happened some other time. And then there were some clues that talked about when these things occurred. And 17 through 18 gives us the clue of Jonathan, which ends up being the grandson of Moses. And he was the Levite that was serving Micah from the tribe of Ephraim. And he ended up then serving the tribe of Dan, who was migrating northward. And I had a couple possibilities for when that occurred, either before Joshua died, which after reading through it, through our daily readings, Victoria and I, I'm leaning more towards that now, that it happened before Joshua died, and mainly because of Judges 18, verse 1. Judges 18, verse 1 says it was before the land was apportioned, before the land was divided. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm leaning more towards that place in the timeline for those two chapters. Another possibility was that it's in the time of Othniel, which I have up here, which is the first judge. And another possibility is that the migration of Dan was an event that was spaced out over a period of time. So that's another possibility. We also looked at a little bit about Judges 19 through 21. This event talks about a war with Benjamin, which is why I called it the War with Benjamin. And the time statement, or at least the thing that helps us place this in time, is that Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron, is serving as high priest at this time. So this has to be earlier on in the period of the judges. Phinehas would have had to have been very old if it happened after Samson. And we'll find out later that after Samson is during the judgeship of Samuel. And And, well, we'll talk about that when we get there. So, we have to place this, because Phinehas is serving as the high priest at this time, we have to place this after Eleazar dies, Eleazar his father, which is around the same time that Joshua dies, a little bit after when Joshua dies. So we have to place it from there, and then as long as Phinehas is alive, which if he's around 20 or so when we first see him in Numbers 25, then that means he was 80s. I have another timeline we're going to look at when we get to it. 80s when the events in Judges 19 through 21 took place. And that is possible. That is likely. That is a thing that could have happened. All right, so there's that. Any comments or questions? I think I had something else I wanted to say about that, but I can't think of it right now. Ah, yes, I remember now. One of the events that occurs with the war with Benjamin is the effective destruction of the entire tribe of Benjamin. And that is something that it's a very bizarre tale in the sense that you kind of see a mob mentality. You read toward the end of Judges that that there was no king in Israel and people did what was right in their own eyes. And you see that after they conquered all the warriors in Benjamin, then it feels like a sense of, it reads like a sense of bloodlust or something had come upon the Israelites, and then they destroyed all of Benjamin, practically, except for 600 soldiers that had hidden in the mountains. And so, and that those are all men, so they didn't have any women left of Benjamin. So how do they propagate? How do they continue? We know that Saul is of the tribe of Benjamin. We know that Paul later in the New Testament is from the tribe of Benjamin. So they had to have survived at least through New Testament times. And we see that Ehud, the second judge that's talked about, is also from the tribe of Benjamin. So if this happens before Ehud, what happens? Well, again, this is probably one of the darker moments in Israelite history, where we see that the people of Israel had vowed not to give their wives to the Benjamites. Give their daughters to Benjamin as wives. Thank you. And not to do that. They had made that vow. And so how are they going to keep their vow and allow Benjamin to survive? Well,
like you said, everybody did what was right in their own mind. Whether they took a vow or not, did that hold it through? You know, if somebody said, well, I really don't believe this, but I'll say I do, and then go do another thing.
There's a strange mentality, and I say strange, but it's a mentality that they had back then where their word meant something. And while today, very often, one's word hardly means anything, I mean, you need a contract or something in order for one's word to mean anything. Back then, that meant something. And in Hebrews chapter 6, it talks about how the swearing of an oath makes it so that it brings assurance to a particular thing. And, you know, we often say things idly, and they did too back then, but when they swore to something, they meant it. It was meant as a confirmation that it was going to happen. Jephthah, we'll see, did that in Judges 11. We see that the people of Israel did that in Judges 20 and 21. So how did Benjamin survive? Well, they looked around. They found a tribe or a town that had not been represented in that vow. And so they said, well, this talent has not come to help us, so we are going to destroy everyone in that town, kill all the men and women who had been married or had known a man intimately. And so they had 400 virgins that they found, and this town is Jabesh-Gilead. And so they did that, and they took those 400 virgins and gave them as wives to Benjamin. But Benjamin only had 600 people, so there were 200 men that were left out. Where are they going to find the 200 women? Well, another terrible thing. They decide that there were some dancing girls going to Shiloh. And Shiloh was where the Ark of the Covenant was. Shiloh was where the tabernacle was. And these dancing girls would go. And then then they told the Benjamites, hey, why don't you just take 200 of the virgins there and make them your wives? And if anyone complains about it, say, oh, well, we didn't, you didn't allow this to happen, so you're not breaking your vow. As, again, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. They had, and it was, it said they had no king. And one of the points that the teacher of this class in preaching school made was that they had no king because not even God was their king. God was supposed to be their king, but they didn't treat him like that. And so what we see is that Benjamin survives through chaos, it was destroyed through chaos, and then survives through means that are abhorrent.
It's a great example of what happens when you do not, I can't say they didn't have a central law, because they had a central law, but they paid no attention to it, and nobody enforced it.
And
the law being the law of God, and God did.
And we see the Levites talked about in Judges, well, the Levite, Jonathan, in Judges 17 and 18, who was serving Micah and later Dan as a priest for an idol. and so you see even the Levites weren't holding to that. Judges 19, we see another Levite who had a concubine, and Levites weren't supposed to have concubines. They were supposed to marry virgins. That's what they were supposed to do, as we see in the books of the law. And so that's not what you were supposed to do. And so that was a, they just weren't following what the Bible said. They weren't following what the law had told them. And so even if the breakdown of the Levites occurs, what does that say about the people?
By example.
Yeah.
Could say they were way ahead of their time. Sounds like modern day religion.
Yeah. Yeah. If the religious leaders fail, where does that leave the people? That's right. It is a grave responsibility that the religious leaders have in doing God's will, in leading the people, shepherding the people in the direction that they need to go. So, Ehud, what do we remember about Ehud? What are some interesting things? He has a short section in Judges chapter 3. What do we remember about Ehud? Well, besides he was a Benjamite. Was he right-handed or left-handed?
It could be Amadeus.
No.
If
I'm asking the question, he's probably left-handed. That's right. He was left-handed. You remember he strapped a dagger, a short sword, on his right thigh, and he pulled it. He was going to tell the king of Moab, King Eglon of Moab, a secret, and he goes in and he says, "This is a message from God." And then And Eglon was a very fat man, according to the scripture. And so he pulls out the dagger and stabs him. And boy, when I was a kid, I loved this story. He stabs him so much so that the hilt of the dagger was swallowed up in the fat. And his entrails spilled everywhere. Loved that story when I was a kid. And what's funnier is Ehud leaves, and the staff of Eglon are just sitting there waiting, you know, waiting until he's done with his business, and is just kind of waiting until they get embarrassed, is what it says. And they're like, man, what's taking him so long? He must be busy, he must be taking care of things, I don't know. Open the door, and he's lying there dead with his guts everywhere. Again, my 12-year-old self thought that was amazing. So, and even today, you know, my 12-year-old inner self gets a little bit of weird delight out of that. It's just funny. But Ehud is a left-handed man, and we see in Judges chapter 20 that there was an elite force of Benjamite soldiers who were left-handed. And we see through the course of time that if this happens during Othniel's judgeship or perhaps before, then there's perhaps 40 years and then 18 years of Moabite oppression and then 80 years under Ehud. So I believe Ehud was likely the son of one of these Benjamite soldiers that survived in the latter part of Judges. Or the latter part of the book of Judges. So that's my thought on that. So if the Benjamites hadn't gotten wives from Jabesh-Gilead and from Shiloh, there wouldn't have been an Ehud. And Israel would not have been delivered from the Moabites. Now, granted, it's very likely that that God would have found somebody else. God has a way of doing that. God has a way of finding just the right person at the right time. There was somebody had made a comment at some point somewhere saying, what if Mary had refused to give birth to Jesus? Had refused God and said, no, I won't do this. Well, you have to think about that first. Would God have asked someone who would have said no? No. And second, it was a huge honor to have done something like that, and it had been built up since Genesis 3:15. And so people were waiting for this kind of thing to happen, and it was considered an honor, so the likelihood of someone saying no is very low. But there's, you know, God would have chosen the right person to have said yes. I mean, he chose Moses, right? Moses said no initially, or tried to give excuses initially, but God kept saying, hey, you can do this. And here's Aaron to help you. So there's a lot of things to talk about that. All right. Any comments or questions before we move on to, we're going to look at Ruth and see when that occurred. But before we do that, do we have any questions or comments? All right. Let us look at the book of Ruth, chapter 1. And we're going to look at verses 1 through 4. Well, we'll look at 1 through 5. And whoever's got that, if you will, please read.
Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the women survived her two sons and her husband.
All right, so when did this occur? Well, it says what in verse 1? In the period of the judges. So when in the period of judges? We've got 317 years to choose from. Well, there are a lot of different possibilities. I'm going to move on to the next one. We're going to look at figure 5, if you've got your handout. I have placed Ruth in the time period of Ehud and Gideon. One of the things we have to recognize is that we have 317 years to play with, but we have 400 plus years of time periods talked about in the book of Judges. So we have to have some overlap somewhere. And so the trick is trying to figure out what makes the most sense. What makes the most sense for periods of overlap? And what you have to do is you have to look at places where these people were. You have to look at language. You have to look at all these different things that are talked about within the book of Judges. And we'll get more into that after we talk about Ruth. But for the moment, for the time being, I will simply say that I believe at least, I think the most likely at this point is that Ehud and Gideon were contemporaries, that they were at the same time. Here's why. First, let us consider the genealogy. The genealogy of David is in the book of Ruth, at the end of the book of Ruth, is Perez, Hezron, Ram, thank you, Amminadab, Nashon, Salmon, Boaz, Obed, Jesse, David. We already talked about earlier that Nashon was the one who ruled Judah, or who led Judah out of Egypt. So he had to have been at the time of the Exodus. And of course, he had to have died in the wilderness. We see that Judah, Perez, and Hezron all entered into Egypt at the same time. And now Hezron might have been a baby. We'll grant that. That's okay. But we have Ram, Amminadab, and Nashon all born in Egypt, some of whom I'm sure were born under slavery. So then we have what's left: Salmon, Boaz, Obed, Jesse, David. We see in Matthew chapter 1 that Salmon married Rahab. And of course, Rahab we see in Joshua chapter 2 and also chapter 6. And she continued with them. There is a Jewish tradition that says that Salmon was one of the spies that went into Jericho in Joshua chapter 2. So that's kind of a cute story, I think. If Salmon was one of the spies that went into Jericho, then he met Rahab, and Rahab saved her future husband's life. And I think that's an interesting thing, if true. Now, I'm not saying it's certainly true, but, you know, it's a possibility. Then we see Boaz, the son of Salmon, marrying Ruth, Obed, and then Jesse and David. Now, a lot of people will try to say that because there's only three generations separating Boaz and David, then the book of Ruth must have happened toward the latter part of the period of the Judges. Well, that doesn't make sense, because then Boaz would have been really old if he lived that long. Boaz was the first generation born after they went into the Promised Land. Now, there is a possibility that perhaps the genealogies skipped a name or skipped generations here or there. But the problem with that is that this genealogy is listed in three different places with no variation at all. Not even, well, except for the name of Salmon, there's no spelling variations even. So we have the book of Ruth that talks about it, the book of 1 Chronicles, and the book of Matthew that give this genealogy without any variation save the name of Salmon. Salma, I think, is the name that another passage calls it. So I don't think there's a skip. I don't think there's anything that talks about a skip in terms of the generations that are listed there. So what that means is that from Salmon to David, there's about an average age of 97, about 97, for when the next child was born. That might seem old, and it is old. 97 for when the next child was born. So Salmon, average age was 97 when Boaz was born. Boaz, average age, 97 when Obed was born. Obed, average age 97 when Jesse was born. Jesse, average age of 97 when David was born. But think about this. David was not the firstborn, was he? Right? He was the seventh, right? Seventh or eighth, somewhere around there. And he was one of the last kids to have been born. Let's look at 1 Samuel chapter 17. Somebody read verse 12. 1 Samuel 17 and verse 12.
Now David was the son of... Oh, I've been over my head.
Ephrathite.
Of Bethlehem, of Judah, whose name was Jesse, who had 8 sons, and the man was old, advanced in years, and the days were tall.
All right, so... It says right there, Jesse was old, advanced in years. Now, we see that applying to a lot of different ages, but it is entirely possible. 97 when David was born, and David was a teenager, let's say 15. So that'll be about 112, somewhere around there. Again, that's unusual for today, but in we see Levi live to 130-something. We see all these people back then living to 100-plus. And to contrast with that, we look at the genealogy of Samuel in 1 Chronicles chapter 6. I believe it's 6. In 1 Chronicles chapter 6, we see the genealogy from Korah. Do you remember Korah from Numbers chapter 16? Korah was one of the ones who rebelled while they were wandering in the wilderness. And Korah was killed. But later on it says that Korah's children were not killed. Because we would assume that Korah's children were not involved in Korah's rebellion. So there's Korah. And then we've got several other people going along the line. Abiasaph, Asir, Tehath, Zephaniah, Azariah, Joel, Elkanah, Amasai, Mahath, Elkanah, Zuf, Toa, Eliel, Jeroham, Elkanah, and Samuel. We see Elkanah show up a couple times. We know from 1 Samuel chapter 1 that Elkanah was the name of Samuel's father. And so we see that's a family name. So we see Elkanah and Samuel toward the end of that. And that is an average of 23 years when their son was born. So we do see that they're pretty meticulous talking about Samuel's genealogy. Why wouldn't they be for David's? So another reason why... Yes?
Boaz commended Ruth for choosing him over the younger men.
That's right. That's right. So that is another thing to mention. Remember that Boaz was likely an older... Well, I'm just reading the book of Ruth without doing this study. We recognize that Boaz was an older man compared to Ruth, Ruth being a young woman. Ruth was a widow, but it is implied that she's a young widow.
She'd been married 10 years to her first husband, it said.
Possibly. They were in the land of Moab for 10 years. Not sure how long Ruth had been married to... is it Mahlon? I can't remember which one. It does mention later on in chapter 4 which one that she was married to. So, we see that Boaz was definitely an older man. Now, wait a second. So, does that mean Boaz was in his 90s when he married Ruth? Not necessarily. Let's look at Ruth chapter 4. Somebody read verse 13.
So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son.
That's an interesting phrase, isn't it? The Lord gave her conception. You know, I don't know how long that Boaz or that Ruth was married to Mahlon. There it is, you're right, Mahlon. I'm not sure how long that she was married to him, but she obviously didn't have any children by him. So if that's the case, then perhaps she was barren. Now, it doesn't say that, so I can't say that for certain. But maybe that's the case, and the Lord gave her conception with Boaz many years later. It's a guess. I don't know. It's an educated guess, sure, but it's still, you know, there's still some room for that not being the case because the Bible doesn't explicitly say that Ruth was barren. Yes.
You could say it's a hunch.
I could. Oh, incidentally, before Boaz met Ruth, what was Boaz?
He was a family leader.
He was ruthless.
Oh, okay. Now I can remember that.
All right. So let's see. Ah, another reason. So here's why I place Ruth in the time of Ehud and Moab. First, it has to be early on in the period of the judges because of the fact that Boaz was Salmon's son. And because of the genealogies, it has to be early on. Second, what famine do we read about in the book of Judges? Do we read about a famine in the book of Judges? Let's look at Judges chapter 6. Judges chapter 6 talks about the Midianite oppression, and later on talks about the judge Gideon. All right, Judges chapter 6. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel because of the Midianites, the children of Israel, made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. So it was, whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up, also Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. And they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts, both they and their camels, and were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. So, we see essentially a forced famine that the Midianites imposed upon the Israelites in this particular time. Now, it's possible that there was another famine that's talked about that is not talked about in the book of Judges in the time period there, but why don't we just make these fit? Well, there are a couple reasons why I think that this is possible, even likely. The Moabites in the time of Ehud, or before Ehud, did not oppress Israel alone. When we look at Judges chapter 3, it is the Moabites who are leading them, the Ammonites who are involved, and the Amalekites. So these three peoples are involved in oppressing Israel at the time of Ehud. What did we just read about the Midianite oppression? In Judges chapter 6, we see that it's the Midianites, the Amalekites, and the people of the east. Where is Ammon and Moab in relation to Israel? North, south, east, or west? Not much. That the Moabites and Eglon had about 11 years in. So that's what I think on there. That they operate. So, because they operate in different areas, and because the oppressions seem, at least the people who oppress them, are very similar, I think it is likely that leaves room for the possibility of Ehud and Gideon being contemporaries. When we look at the end of Judges chapter 8, near the end of Judges chapter 8, we see that the land had rest for 40 years under Gideon. It doesn't say that the land had rest for only 40 years. It said under Gideon. For Ehud, it said just the land had rest for 80 years. So, because the land had rest for 40 years under Gideon, and under Ehud, 80 years, that leaves room for the possibility of Abimelech showing up in Judges chapter 9 for his 3-year reign. In that particular passage, if you remember, Gideon had a son, had several sons, a lot of sons, and Abimelech rises up, and after Gideon dies and says and gets has all of his brothers killed save one, the youngest, and that's just because he overlooked him, and he says, "I'm going to reign in Israel," and he has the backing of some towns. And so he reigns in Israel for 3 years before he's put down. So that's perhaps a weak point to this theory about Abimelech, about Gideon and Ehud being contemporaries. That's, I think, one of the weaker points, because Abimelech then would imply that there's not rest. But again, it's not rest from outside. So that's where I'm leaning towards that there's no outside oppression at that time. It's rest for 80 years until the Canaanites come in and Deborah and Barak take care of them in Judges 4 and 5. All right, we don't have a whole lot of time left. Does that make sense? Are you going to tar and feather me for saying that Ehud and Gideon are contemporaries? And the reason I say that is because there are some things that might go against that theory. There's no indication, other than the circumstantial evidence I just gave, that Ehud and Gideon were at the same time. It's only circumstantial evidence. The Moabites are focused on in Judges 3 because Ehud deals directly with the king of Moab. And so that's why we call it the Moabite oppression. The Midianites are focused on in Judges 6, 7, and 8 because they are involved with what we see later in Judges 8, that the Midianites, they call them Ishmaelites, and they had earrings. And so Gideon took those earrings and said, "I'm going to make a golden ephod out of those," and that became a stumbling block to the children of Israel afterwards. And because he was in the north, and Deborah and Barak did their thing up in the north, then, you know, it's likely that the Canaanites oppressed them up there at that time because of the golden ephod. And then later, after that, we see Tola and Jerah, and then the Ammonites and Philistines, which we'll talk about later when we get more time later on. Because this gets confusing later on. I'm not going to lie. And that's because pretty soon we're going to include the first 12 chapters of 1 Samuel. And we're going to include it because a lot of it takes place at the same time as the Judges. At least that's where, with the conclusion that I have drawn. So, any comments or questions? I don't think... Yes?
I would say it confuses.
Yeah. Well, there's one theory that the Canaanite... Well, that the that Deborah and Gideon, their 40-year rest was at the same time. But I don't think that's possible because both Gideon and Deborah had their wars in the north. And so because they're in the same place, I don't think it's likely that those two were at the same time. So this answers the question of Boaz being early on in the genealogy. This answers the question of the famine that takes place in the land of Israel and the reason why Elimelech and Naomi move. And this helps with, because this is corroborated by the names of the people who oppress them being the same or very similar, if not exactly the same, and the fact that Ehud and Gideon operated in different areas of Israel. So that hits all four of those points, and that's the reason why I think that those two are the same time. Did I confuse you? I hope not. I hope that... And the reason why we're going over this, and I want to, you know, this is not just some pet project that I'm sharing with everybody. This is trying to make sense of the narrative of Scripture. Because we there will be skeptics who come up and say that we have, we have 400 plus years talked about in Judges, but you only have 300 plus years to play with. How do you reconcile those things? Where do you put Ruth? What is the overall historical context of Ruth? Where do you put the last few chapters of Judges? What is the overall context of that? It helps us to understand where these things take place, when these things take place, and this overall context of Scripture. And to be fair, when we look at the period of the Judges, this is educated guesses, speculation, but what this does do is it gives us a possibility for what happened. And if we have a possibility of what happened, not an exact truth, then we have a way to defend ourselves against the skeptics. Because if we have a possibility, then that means it could have happened. And that means the skeptic doesn't, you know, what he says isn't necessarily the absolute truth. And so that builds faith in our minds for the truth of the Scriptures. All right. Thank you.